category. They are the smallest in number, yet the greatest in variety. They are the most individually painful, but they may also be the most collectively uplifting. There is something heartening about grown women and men waking up at night, despairing over incidents decades earlier in their lives in which they hurt others, acted unfairly, or compromised the values of their community. It suggests that stamped somewhere in our DNA and buried deep in our souls is the desire to be good. All deep structure regrets reveal a need and yield a lesson. With moral regrets, the need is goodness. The lesson, which we've heard in religious texts, philosophy tracts, and parental admonitions, is this: when in doubt, do the right thing.
喂养一只兔子，因为溺虫，放出铁笼子后。
While feeding and petting a rabbit, I accidentally let him escape from his cage, and then he ate a bunch of plastic and died.
Female, 38, China.
An action. Not asking a girl out, not starting a business sooner, not applying to speak at the conference. I regret inaction more than any mistake I've ever made. Male, 43, Canada.
Not taking my grandmother candy on her deathbed. She specifically requested it. Male, 35, Arkansas.
10. Connection regrets. To understand connection regrets, let me tell you the story of four women, two friendships, and a pair of doors. The first woman is Cheryl Johnson, a native of Des Moines, Iowa, a resident of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the former research director at a publishing company. Cheryl is in her early 50s. She's devoted to her husband, her gym, and her latest projects, a house she's building, and a book she's writing. In the late 1980s, Cheryl attended Drake University, also in Des Moines, where she became fast friends with the second woman in this tale. Her name is Jen. Cheryl and Jen belonged to the same sorority and lived in a house with about 40 other women. Among the group, these two stood out for their seriousness and ambition. Cheryl became president of the sorority. Jen was elected president of the entire student body. We took our college careers a little more seriously than the typical student, and that made us oddballs, Jen told me. We connected in part because we felt on the fringes of things socially. They talked all the time. They supported each other's enthusiasms and aspirations. They hatched big plans to take on the world. Shortly after graduation in 1990, Jen married. Cheryl was a bridesmaid and moved to Virginia. And shortly after that, Jen invited Cheryl to visit her at her new home. Jen said that she wanted Cheryl to meet a friend of Jen's husband who she thought might be a good romantic match. Cheryl was taken aback. She'd been dating another Drake student for 2 years. I thought he was the one. Jen knew the guy, but Cheryl said she clearly did not think he was the one. Cheryl politely declined the invitation to visit. No drama, no hard feelings. Over the next few years, Cheryl and Jen, living in different parts of the country at a time before widespread email, exchanged letters and cards. Cheryl eventually ditched the boyfriend, whom she refers to today only as Mr. Wrong, and says, "Now that I've matured into the person I am, I can see what Jen saw." Within a couple of years, the letters dwindled. Then they stopped. Cheryl hasn't talked to Jen for 25 years. They haven't seen each other in person since Jen's wedding. "We didn't have a falling out of any kind. I just let it kind of drift away," Cheryl told me. "I regret not having that relationship in my life. I've missed having another person in my life who could share with me the kind of growth I've experienced over the years." The absence disquiets her. "If you're going to die in a month, are there things you would want tied up?" Cheryl said. "I would like her to know that the friendship feels significant to me, even 25 years later." During a conversation over Zoom one spring afternoon, I asked Cheryl if she'd consider trying to revive the friendship, or at least to call, email, or write Jen. "I think the door's open," she replied. "If I were not a coward, I would reach out." Connection regrets are the largest category in the deep structure of human regret. They arise from relationships that have come undone or that remain incomplete. The types of relationship that produce these regrets vary: spouses, partners, parents, children, siblings, friends, colleagues. The nature of the rupture also varies. Some relationships fray, others rip. A few were inadequately stitched from the beginning. But in every case, these regrets share a common plot line. A relationship that was once intact, or that ought to have been intact, no longer is. Sometimes, often because of a death, there is nothing more that we can do. However, many times, in many roles, daughter, uncle, sorority sister, we yearn to close the circle. But doing so requires effort, brings emotional uncertainty, and risks rejection. So we confront a choice: try to make the relationship whole or let it remain unresolved. Connection regrets sound like this: "If only I'd reached out." Closed doors and open doors. The third woman in the story is Amy Nobler. Amy, who lives in Pasadena, California, grew up in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. In middle school, she met a girl whom I'll call Deepa. Deepa was a latchkey kid whose parents worked demanding jobs and whose house stood just blocks from the school they attended. Amy and Deepa would head there after classes, forging a friendship in the freedom of an empty house. Amy remembers those afternoons as some of the happiest times of her life. "It was everything you think about connecting with a close friend," she told me. Amy and Deepa stayed friendly in high school and stayed in touch after graduation as they moved on with college, careers, and families. Deepa came to Amy's wedding in 1998. Their families were so close that even Amy's parents attended Deepa's wedding in 2000. For a wedding gift, Amy gave Deepa an elaborate handmade cookbook of her favorite recipes. "There's no other connection like the kind you make in childhood, you know," Amy said. In 2005, Deepa's husband sent a note to all the people in his wife's life, informing them that Deepa had been diagnosed with an aggressive form of cancer. As with many illnesses, the news that followed caromed between scary and reassuring. Deepa went into remission. She had a baby. But in the summer of 2008, the cancer returned and her prospects appeared grim. Deepa's quality of life was fine for the moment, the Facebook update notified friends and family, but she likely had only a year to live. Amy wanted to call her old friend. Amy put off calling her old friend. Late one night in December of 2008, Amy received a message from a mutual friend that Deepa's health had taken a serious downward turn. The following day, Amy called Deepa's home in New Jersey to speak with her. The person who answered the phone explained that Deepa had died earlier that morning. I will never forget how much I realized in that moment the opportunity that had been lost to me, Amy said. My thought was always, did she die wondering why I never called? I will always wonder, and I just swore I was never going to behave that way again. People often talk about regrets in terms of doors. Amy has a closed door regret. As she told me, the opportunity to restore her connection with Deepa is gone. Cheryl has an open door regret. The opportunity to reconnect with her college friend remains. Both types of regrets nag at us, but for different reasons. Closed door regrets distress us because we can't do anything about them. Open door regrets bother us because we can, though it requires effort. In the World Regrets Survey, many participants reported the sense of loss that accompanies a door that has closed. A 51-year-old California man became disconnected from his father at age 7 when his parents divorced. He visited his father every weekend, but the relationship was shallow. No deep conversations nor really getting to know each other. By middle school, the visit stopped. The man reconnected somewhat with his father in his late teens and early 20s, but...
Still, during all that time, we didn't get to build any sort of bond. He passed away 17 years ago, and I often regret not having a beer with him as adult men.
A 54-year-old woman shared this.
I regret not being nicer to my mom. I took her for granted when I was younger, thinking that I was so much smarter than she was. Typical teenager. When I grew up, we argued over politics, both of us passionate about our viewpoints. Now that she is gone, I miss her desperately. So much that it takes my breath away sometimes. I did the daughter thing all wrong. I look at my daughters and pray that they are kinder to me than I was to my own mom, even though I'm not sure I deserve it.
For many people, including a 45-year-old woman from the District of Columbia, the door closed with words left unspoken.
My brother died suddenly at 41. I regret not saying I love you more.
And several regrets resembled this one from a 44-year-old Iowa woman.
I regret not attending the funeral of my college coach and mentor. My baby was only a couple of weeks old. It was winter time with the chance of bad weather, and it was over a 3-hour drive. I type these excuses just as I told them to myself again and again in my decision-making process. I tried to convince myself I made the right decision. Reason, regret, reason, regret, reason, regret. Play ping pong in my brain whenever I think about that event from 15 years ago.
A 2012 study by Mike Morrison, Kai Epstuda, and Neil Rose concluded that regrets about social relationships are felt more deeply than other types of regrets because they threaten our sense of belonging. When our connections to others tatter or disintegrate, we suffer. And when it's our fault, we suffer even more. The need to belong, they wrote, is not just a fundamental human motive, but a fundamental component of regret. Closed-door regrets vex us because we can't fix them. It's over. But doors that cannot budge hide behind them a benefit. They offer another example of how regret can make us better. A few years after Deepa died, Amy learned that another childhood friend had been diagnosed with cancer. I kept revisiting my previous experience with Deepa, Amy said. I really needed to get myself on board for however difficult this would be. Amy called this friend frequently. She visited her. They exchanged emails and texts. I did as much as I was able to make sure she knew she was always in my thoughts. I made a much more concerted effort to be present with her and acknowledge the reality of her situation. The friend passed away in 2015. We maintained a connection up until she died, Amy told me. It didn't make it easier, but I don't have regrets. Rifts and drifts. Cheryl and Jen never argued, not even a small squabble. They never discussed the dissolution of their friendship. It simply faded. While the connection regrets that people reported in the surveys numbered well into the thousands, the specific ways their relationships ended numbered only two. Rifts and drifts. Rifts usually begin with a catalyzing incident, an insult, a disclosure, a betrayal. That incident leads to raised voices, ominous threats, crashed plates, and other mainstays of telenovelas and Edward Albee plays. Rifts leave the parties resentful and antagonistic, even though to outsiders, the underlying grievance might sound trivial and easy to repair. For example, a 71-year-old Canadian man regretted that
a disagreement with my son at Christmas over the behavior of his 5-year-old son, my grandson, turned into a huge, albeit brief, argument. It has resulted in a family estrangement that has lasted almost 5 years. We have not talked or communicated in any way since then.
A 66-year-old Texas woman wrote,
"I regret reacting negatively when I found out my daughter-in-law and my son were immigrating back to her home in Australia after we were led to believe she wanted to live near us. They left and are now estranged."
Drifts follow a muddier narrative. They often lack a discernible beginning, middle, or end. They happen almost imperceptibly. One day the connection exists, another day we look up and it's gone. A Pennsylvania woman regretted,
"Not taking time to be a better friend, sister, daughter. Letting time slip away. And suddenly realizing that I'm 48.
A 41-year-old man in Cambodia wrote,
"I regret letting good friends drift away by not staying in touch."
For many, the situation is recognizable only in retrospect, said a 62-year-old Pennsylvania man.
"I wish I had tried harder to foster deeper relationships with my work colleagues. I've worked at the same place for over 30 years, but I'm not sure I would really call any of the people I've worked with a close friend."
Rifts are more dramatic, but drifts are more common. Drifts can also be harder to mend. Rifts generate emotions like anger and jealousy, which are familiar and easier to identify and comprehend. Drifts involve emotions that are subtler and that can feel less legitimate. And first among these emotions, described by hundreds of people with connection regrets, is awkwardness. When Cheryl has contemplated reconnecting with her old friend, she's asked herself, "Would it be better for Jen not ever to hear from me, or for Jen to hear from me and have it be kind of creepy?" And Cheryl's concern about creepiness have always prevailed. She worries about the weirdness of reaching out after a quarter century. She fears that such a gesture might not seem right to her friend. The same barrier prevented Amy from telephoning Deepa. "There was a sort of awkwardness to me of, 'I haven't really talked to you in years, but hey, I heard you were dying and I'm going to call,'" Amy explained. "I wish I had not been afraid to confront the uncomfortable feelings I knew I was going to have when I called her." If Amy had faced those feelings, she might have been surprised, even gratified. Human beings are impressive creatures. We can fly planes, compose operas, and bake scones, but we generally stink at divining what other people think in anticipating how they will behave. Worse, we don't realize how inept we are at these skills. And when it comes to perceiving and predicting awkwardness, we're next level bunglers. In a 2014 study, social psychologists Nicholas Epley and Juliana Schroeder recruited commuters on trains and buses in the Chicago area and asked some of them to start conversations with strangers. The recruits predicted that doing so would make them feel uncomfortable and that the recipients of their entreaties would suffer even greater awkwardness. They were mistaken on both fronts. Those who initiated conversations found it easier to do than they expected. They enjoyed their commute more than control group participants who remained to themselves, and the strangers with whom they spoke were not put off. They enjoyed the conversations just as much. "People misunderstand the consequences of social connection," Epley and Schroeder wrote. "Commuters feared that reaching out would be uncomfortable for everyone, but their fears were misplaced. It wasn't awkward at all." In a 2020 study, Erica Boothby of the University of Pennsylvania and Vanessa Bonds of Cornell University examined a related phenomenon: our squeamishness about complimenting other people. The prospect of giving compliments, Boothby and Bonds found, can make people skittish. They worry their awkwardness is on display and that people are noticing and judging them for their many flaws and faux pas. But in the experiments, people's predictions about themselves and others proved way off. They drastically overestimated how bothered, uncomfortable, and annoyed the person receiving their compliment would feel, and underestimated how positively that person would react. It wasn't awkward at all. What's going on in these situations is a phenomenon that social psychologists call pluralistic ignorance. we mistakenly assume that our beliefs differ vastly from everyone else's, especially when those private thoughts seem at odds with broader public behavior. So, when we struggle to understand a lecture, we don't ask questions because we erroneously believe that because other people aren't asking questions, that means they understand and we don't want to look dumb. But we don't consider that other people might be equally befuddled and equally nervous about seeming stupid. We're confused, but we stay confused because we falsely believe that nobody but us is confused. Or surveys of college students reveal that most students don't drink excessively. But those students think that they're the exception and that all their classmates are constantly getting hammered, which perversely reinforces a social norm that relatively few people truly endorse. Our concerns about the awkwardness of reconnecting with someone from whom we've drifted conform to this pattern. We too often presume that our own preferences are unique. During a conversation in which Cheryl maintained that Jen would have little interest in reconnecting, and that she would instead consider any communication from Cheryl a little creepy, I asked her to consider the reverse scenario. How would she feel if Jen reached out to her? If I got a message from her today, oh my God, I would burst into tears, she told me. That would be a life-changing thing for me to hear from her and for her to still be thinking about our friendship after all those years. Happiness is love. Full stop. The longest-running examination of the lifetime well-being of a single group of people is the study of adult development at Harvard Medical School, also known as the Grant Study, for one of its creators. You might have heard of it. In 1938, researchers at Harvard recruited 268 undergraduate men and followed them for the next 80 years. The length of the study and its detail are astounding. Researchers measured the men's IQ, analyzed their handwriting, and examined their brows and testicles. They drew blood, took electroencephalograms, and calculated their lifetime earnings. The audacious goal was to try to determine why some people flourished in work and life and others floundered. Despite its obvious limitations, the subjects were all white American men, the Grant Study is one of the most important long-term projects in the history of psychological science. Researchers eventually included the offspring and spouses of these men in the study, and in the 1970s, they added 456 working-class Bostonians to diversify the socioeconomic pool. The combined conclusions of these efforts are considered serious, instructive, and probably universal. As the Harvard Gazette summarized in 2017, close relationships, more than money or fame, are what keep people happy throughout their lives. Those ties protect people from life's discontents, help to delay mental and physical decline, and are better predictors of long and happy lives than social class, IQ, or even genes. That finding proved true across the board among both the Harvard men and the inner city participants. Men who'd had warm childhood relationships with their parents earned more as adults than men whose parent-child bonds were more strained. They were also happier and less likely to suffer dementia in old age. People with strong marriages suffered less physical pain and emotional distress over the course of their lives. Individuals' close friendships were more accurate predictors of healthy aging than their cholesterol levels. Social support and connections to a community helped insulate people against disease and depression. Meanwhile, loneliness and disconnection, in some cases, were fatal. In 2017, Robert Waldinger, a psychiatrist and the current director of the study, described to a journalist the core insight of this research. Taking care of your body is important, but tending to your relationships is a form of self-care too. That, I think, is the revelation. Many people in the World Regret Survey seem to have arrived at a conclusion similar to what the Grant Study found. Take, for example, this 57-year-old California woman.
I regret that I didn't cuddle more with my stepdaughter when she was a child. I didn't want her to think I was trying to replace her mother and didn't realize how much she needed to be mothered.
Or a 62-year-old Ohio woman who said,
"Both my parents, although a year apart, did their hospice at home. I deeply regret not spending more time on their last days, holding hands and speaking about the lovely moments they gave me. We weren't a family that hugged, cried, or kissed, and I didn't know I needed to do that for them or for me."
Or this 71-year-old Floridian.
"When my daughter came out as transgender at the age of 14, I did not understand and did not handle the situation well. As a result, I inflicted incredible pain on my only child and the person I love most in the world. Things have changed since then, and I am her number one supporter now, but I will never forgive myself for not being the parent I should have been when it mattered most."
One remarkable non-finding in the World Regret Survey involved parents. Hundreds of people describe regrets about marrying the wrong spouse or choosing a disappointing partner, but fewer than 20 respondents out of more than 16,000 regretted having children. In some sense, both behavioral science and popular culture have focused too much attention on romance and not enough on other forms of family connection. In fact, in 2020, a group of more than 40 international scholars representing 24 countries examined data from 27 societies around the world and concluded that while academic journals were packed with research on mate seeking, people across the globe actually prioritized goals related to familial bonds over mating goals, directing more research to long-term family relationships, which produce greater and more enduring well-being with fewer downsides than romantic entanglements, would expand our understanding. George Vallant, another Harvard psychiatrist, headed the Grant study for more than 30 years. In an unpublished 2012 manuscript, he reflected on what he learned from the experience. After 8 decades, hundreds of subjects, thousands of interviews, and millions of data points, he said he could summarize the conclusion of the longest-running examination of human flourishing in 5 words. Happiness is love. Full stop. In the end, the problem we contend with as people is remarkably simple. What gives our life significance and satisfaction are meaningful relationships. But when those relationships come apart, whether by intent or inattention, what stands in the way of bringing them back together are feelings of awkwardness. We fear that we'll botch our efforts to reconnect, that we'll make our intended recipients even more uncomfortable. Yet these concerns are almost always misplaced. Sure, we'll get rebuffed sometimes, but more often, much more often, in fact, we overestimate how awkward we'll feel and underestimate how much others will welcome our overtures. So the simple problem has an even simpler solution. Shove aside the awkwardness. When Amy Knobler considers her closed-door regret, she wishes she could travel backward in time and whisper advice to her previous self. She'd assure young Amy that, even though it feels awkward and is super uncomfortable and scary, on the other side of it, you will be glad you went through that experience, not only because you didn't have those unanswered questions in your mind at that point, but also for what it does for the other person. And when Cheryl Johnson gazes at the open door of her relationship with Jen, she has an instinct about her next move, even if she won't, for now at least, act on it. You're almost always better off to err on the side of showing up. And if it's awkward, then it's awkward and you'll live. It'll be fine. But if you don't show up, it's lost forever. All deep structure regrets reveal a need and yield a lesson. With connection regrets, the human need is love. Not only love in the romantic sense, but a broader version of love that includes attachment, devotion, and community, and that encompasses parents, children, siblings, and friends. The lesson of closed doors is to do better next time. The lesson of open doors is to do something now. If a relationship you care about has come undone, place the call, make that visit, say what you feel, push past the awkwardness, and reach out.
My biggest regrets stem from not being more assertive at various points about my needs and wishes. Education, relationships, vacation plans, right down to the food that winds up in my house. Male, 51, New Jersey.
I wish I had planted more trees. Male, 57, United Kingdom.
I regret putting my life on display for so long on social media. There are too many times I overshared, and now it feels like too much of me is just out there. Female, 27, Washington.
11. Opportunity and obligation. Photography was more complicated and expensive back in the 20th century, before every phone had a camera and every pocket had a phone. Gather around, youngsters, and I'll explain. In those bygone days, photographers shot their photos on film. They'd press a button to open their camera's shutter, which would momentarily let in light. The light would then interact with the chemicals on the film to memorialize an image. The result was a bit odd. On the strip of film that photographers removed from the camera, the light spots appeared dark and the dark spots light. This was called a negative, and it was the middle step in the production process. When photographers printed that negative on paper, the light and dark would be reversed and the original color tones restored. Regret works much the same way. The four core regrets operate as a photographic negative of the good life. If we know what people regret the most, we can reverse that image to reveal what they value the most. So, what do we all ultimately want and need? The deep structure of regret provides an answer. We seek a measure of stability, a reasonably sturdy foundation of material, physical, and mental well-being. We hope to use some of our limited time to explore and grow by pursuing novelty and being bold. We aspire to do the right thing, to be and to be seen as good people who honor our moral commitments. We yearn to connect with others, to forge friendships and family relationships bonded by love. A solid foundation, a little boldness, basic morality, meaningful connections, the negative emotion of regret reveals the positive path for living. Coulda and shoulda. Each time you look in the mirror, you see one person. But if you squint a little harder, you might see three selves. That is the idea animating a theory of motivation that Torrey Higgins, a Columbia University social psychologist, first proposed in 1987. Higgins argued that we all have an actual self, an ideal self, and an ought self. Our actual self is the bundle of attributes that we currently possess. Our ideal self is the self we believe we could be, our hopes, wishes, and dreams. And our ought self is the self we believe we should be, our duties, commitments, and responsibilities. What fuels our behavior and directs which goals we pursue, Higgins argued, are discrepancies between these three selves. For instance, if my ideal self is someone who's healthy and physically fit, but my actual self is lethargic and overweight, that gap might motivate me to start exercising. If my ought self believes in caring for elderly relatives, but my actual self hasn't visited grandma in 6 months, I might leave the office early and to grandmother's house I will go. However, when we don't make these efforts, when a discrepancy persists between who we are and who we could or should be, unpleasant feelings flood the gap. In 2018, Shai Davide of the New School for Social Research and the ubiquitous Thomas Gilovich enlisted Higgins' theory to analyze regret. Expanding on Gilovich's earlier research showing that, over time, people regret inactions more than actions, they conducted six studies that reached a single conclusion. People regret their failures to live up to their ideal selves more than their failures to live up to their ought selves. Regrets of coulda outnumbered regrets of shoulda by about 3-1. The likely reason is the contrasting emotional consequences of these two flavors of regret. Discrepancy between our actual self and our ideal self leaves us dejected. But discrepancies between our actual self and our ought self make us agitated, and therefore more likely to act. We feel a greater sense of urgency about our ought-related regrets, so we're more likely to begin repair work by undoing past behavior, apologizing to those we've wronged, or learning from our mistakes. Couldas bug us longer than shouldas because we end up fixing many of the shouldas. This analysis offers another window into the deep structure of regret. Failures to become our ideal selves are failures to pursue opportunities. Failures to become our ought selves are failures to fulfill obligations. All four of the core regrets involve opportunity, obligation, or both. For example, boldness regrets, if only I'd taken that risk, are entirely about opportunities we didn't seize. Foundation regrets, if only I'd done the work, are also largely about opportunities for education, health, financial well-being that we didn't pursue. Connection regrets, if only I'd reached out, are a mix. They involve opportunities for friendship that we didn't follow through on, as well as obligations to family members and others that we neglected. Moral regrets, if only I'd done the right thing, are about obligations we didn't meet. The result is that opportunity and obligation sit at the center of regret, but opportunity has the more prominent seat. This also helps explain why we're more likely to regret what we didn't do than what we did. As Neil Rose and Amy Somerville have written, regrets of inaction last longer than regrets of action, in part because they reflect greater perceived opportunity. The importance of opportunity became clearer when I re-examined the data I collected in the American Regret Project, the quantitative portion of my research. The size and breadth of this survey allowed me to investigate differences between subgroups. Do women's regrets differ from men's? Do Black Americans hold different regrets than white Americans? Do life regrets depend on whether you're rich or poor? The short answer is that group differences were not massive. The longer and more intriguing answer is that the differences that did emerge reinforced the centrality of opportunity as a driver of regret. Take, for example, the education level of respondents. People with college degrees were more likely to have career regrets than people without college degrees. At first, that might seem surprising. Having a college degree generally affords people a wider set of professional options. But that could be precisely why college graduates have more career regrets. Their lives presented more opportunities, and therefore a larger universe of foregone opportunities. Income presented a similar pattern. Regrets about finance, not surprisingly, correlated tightly with household income. The lower the household income, the more likely someone was to have a finance-related regret. But regrets about careers ran in the reverse direction. That is, the higher the income, the more likely it was that someone had a career regret. Again, more opportunities could beget more regrets about unrealized opportunities. Regrets about education were most prevalent among people who had attended college but had not graduated. For 1 in 4 people in this group, education constituted their greatest regret. In this case, impeded opportunity may be the reason. Thwarted opportunity is the likely reason for the one racial gap that emerged in the survey. Racial differences in regret were minimal, except on a single dimension. People who were not white had more regrets about education than white people, which is likely explained by the racial disparities in access to educational opportunities in the United States. Age also showed the importance and paradox of opportunity. In the American Regret Project survey, 20-year-olds had equal numbers of action and inaction regrets. But as people grew older, inaction regrets began to dominate. By age 50, inaction regrets were twice as common as action regrets. Indeed, according to the data, age was by far the strongest predictor of regrets of inaction. When the universe of opportunities before them has dwindled, as it has with older folks, people seem to regret what they haven't done. Yet, they also look for opportunities in different places. For example, among those ages 30 to 65, regrets about career and finance were most prevalent, likely because at that stage of life, opportunities were still alive in those realms. But as people aged, they tended to have fewer regrets about education, health, and career, and more regrets about family. One reason? At age 70, the opportunities are relatively limited to get a PhD or launch a new career or compensate for decades of hard living. Those doors are closing. But the opportunity remains to reconcile with your estranged brother before both of you pass on. That door remains open. Differences between men and women were not vast, but they were present. For example, men were more likely than women to have career regrets. About 1 in 5 men express regrets in this category, but only 12% of women. By contrast, women were more likely than men to have family regrets, 24% of women versus 18% of men. The survey didn't ask questions that can deliver a definitive explanation for this difference, but we can speculate that men, on average, may be more likely to value professional opportunities, and women, on average, may be more likely to value relationship opportunities. Dreams and duties. We regret foregone opportunities more often than unfulfilled obligations. Yet we also know that a wholly realized life involves a mix of both dreams and duties. The photographic negative that regret offers makes clear that being fully human combines our dreams for ourselves and our duties to others. A life of obligation and no opportunity is crimped. A life of opportunity and no obligation is hollow. A life that fuses opportunity and obligation is true. How to build that life by transforming your existing regrets and anticipating your future regrets is the subject of the rest of this audiobook. Part 3. Regret Remade.
I stopped being nice to Jessica. And when she got her period at school, which lasted 3 days, I called her Bloody Mary. Female, 39, North Carolina.
I regret every kiss I could have given to my wife, but didn't, because I was too busy during our 62 years of marriage before she died of COVID. Male, 84, Texas.
I regret not learning how to read music or play an instrument. I realize now it is a valuable skill that's good for you, even if you are not into music. Female, 17, Japan.
12. Undoing and at-leasting. Jeff Bosley was just trying to be cool. He'd enlisted in the U.S. Army at age 29. And was now the oldest grunt at Fort Bragg, older even than his drill sergeant. He wanted to fit in. So one night, he and a few buddies left the base, drove into town, and entered a tattoo shop. Jeff was seeking an image or phrase that would impress his comrades, a hyper-macho symbol, as he put it, to broadcast his warrior philosophy. He chose his left arm as the tattoo's site because that's the arm I'd see when I'm holding my rifle barrel. The shop artist opened a Microsoft Word program on a nearby computer, and they selected the papyrus font. And there, on Jeff's left arm, for about $100, the artist inked 9 black letters. No regrets. Jeff served in the Army for nearly a decade and became a Green Beret. After the military, he worked as a firefighter in Colorado Springs, Colorado. During that stage of his life, he and his wife of 12 years divorced. And when his marriage ended, he discovered something about himself. He had plenty of regrets. He regretted not taking college, 8 years, 2 schools, no degree, more seriously. He regretted hurting his wife by seeking a divorce. He regretted never pursuing his longtime love of acting. 14 years after that impetuous evening decision, Jeff realized that his tattoo wasn't just unaesthetic, it was also untrue. Regret is a thing, Jeff said when we talk. I do have regret. It fuels me. Regret sucks, but I like that better than people who say, no regrets, or I don't have regrets. Prodded by this regret, he moved from central Colorado to Southern California, where he's now making a living as an actor. And prodded by the constant reminder of a credo he no longer believed, he decided to have the no regrets tattoo removed. The process is painful, time-consuming, and expensive. It involves regular laser sessions at a dermatology office and costs more than 10 times the original ink. Every time I go to the removal place, if it's a new nurse or technician, I say, I get it. The joke is not lost on me. What do we do with our regrets? If regrets make us human, how do we enlist them to make us better, more satisfied people? The starting point is to revisit one of the key distinctions in the architecture of regret, the difference between regrets of action and regrets of inaction, between regretting what we did and regretting what we didn't do. Action regrets are less prevalent, and in this short chapter, I'll explain how you can transform them to adjust the present. In the next chapter, I'll take on the more complex challenge of how you can transform both varieties of regret to improve your future. For action regrets, your initial goal should be to change the immediate situation for the better. That's not always possible, but we have two ways to advance toward that goal. We can undo many such regrets, we can make amends, reverse our choices, or erase the consequences. Think of Jeff and his now fading tattoo. We can also respond to action regrets by using at leasts to help us feel better about our circumstances. Neither tack does much to prepare us for later, but both can help us realign now. Step 1. Undo it. Suppose that without provocation, you slapped your best friend in the face or said something snarky about the deceased to his relatives at his funeral. You'd probably regret it. Most of us would. But only an entertainment executive would see within these indiscretions the seeds of a television show. Het Spijt Me was a program that began airing on Dutch television in 1993 and continued to run in various iterations for the next 20 years. The basic format of the show, in English, the title is I Am Sorry, always involved two protagonists. The first was the person with a regret, say the one who'd smacked her bestie. The second was the person who'd been wronged, the individual on the receiving end of said smack. In the original version of the show, the regretter, sitting on a couch, talk show style, before a studio audience, would tell Het Spijt Me's host about her regret. Then, they'd watch footage of the show's producer tracking down the regrettee, hearing the story from her point of view, and asking if she'd accept an apology. It being Holland, flowers were always involved. If the regrettee accepted the apology, she'd stride through a pair of sliding doors and greet the regretteur on stage. In subsequent versions of the program, the regretteur waited down the street from the regrettee's home. As amends were made, tears were shed, and hugs exchanged. Three Dutch researchers, led by social psychologist Marcel Zeelenberg, a leading scholar of regret, analyzed two seasons of Het Spijt Me to determine which regrets people sought to reverse. They found that on the show, as well as in the non-televised parts of our life, people are much more likely to undo regrets of action than regrets of inaction. We're more apt to repair what we did than what we didn't do. The reasons are many. As we heard in chapters 8 and 9, action regrets typically arise from concrete incidents and elicit hot emotions that we respond to quickly. Inaction regrets, by contrast, are often more abstract and elicit less immediately intense emotions. What's more, many inaction regrets are inherently difficult to undo. If in my 20s, I regret not studying hard enough in high school, I can't re-enroll in 11th grade. My only option is to focus on the future. But with regrets of action, I still have the chance to recalibrate the present, to press Control Z on my existential keyboard. For instance, with moral regrets, which often involve actions like bullying a weaker kid, cheating on a spouse, or insulting a coworker, one form of undoing is to apologize. Apologies, wrote the great sociologist Irving Goffman, are admissions of blameworthiness and regret for an undesirable event that allow actors to try to obtain a pardon from audiences. If that pardon is granted, the emotional and moral debt of the past is reduced, which at least partially rebalances the ledger. When we undo what we've done, we improve our current situation. That helps. But undoing a regret is not quite the same as erasing it. Jeff Bosley told me that even after many tattoo removal sessions, the words on his left arm are impossible to read, but they haven't fully disappeared. It almost looks like a light bruise now, he says. So, to address regrets of action, begin by asking yourself these questions. If I've harmed others, as is often the case with moral regrets and sometimes the case with connection regrets, can I make amends through an apology or some form of emotional or material restitution? If I've harmed myself, as is the case for many foundation regrets and some connection regrets, can I fix the mistake? For example, can I begin paying down debt or logging a few more hours at work? Can I reach out immediately to someone whose connection I severed? If the action regret can be undone, try to do that, even if a light physical or metaphysical bruise remains. But if it can't be undone, fear not. You've got another possibility. Step 2. At least it. The other way to address the present is not to repair our previous actions, but to recast the way we think about them. Let me offer an example from my own life. 30 years ago, nearly fresh out of college, I went to law school. I regret it. It wasn't a calamity. It was just a poor decision. If only I'd made a wiser choice, perhaps by waiting longer or by choosing an entirely different trajectory, I could have devoted those years to endeavors more fulfilling and better for the world, and I would have struggled less in the early years of my working life. But I also met my wife in law school, which was a glorious triumph for my well-being. I can't undo an action regret like this, but one way to ease its sting is to switch from if only to at least. Going to law school was a mistake, but at least I met my wife. At least don't alter our behavior or boost our performance in the future, but they do help us reassess the present. For instance, several women in the World Regret Survey listed marrying a previous husband as their greatest regret. But those who were mothers also cherished the children who came from that ill-considered marriage. I regret marrying a loser, they would say, but at least I've got these great kids. Finding a silver lining doesn't negate the existence of a cloud, but it does offer another perspective on that cloud. And while at least can be useful for significant regrets like misguided marriage choices, they are especially helpful for addressing peskier regrets that fall outside the big four categories. For example, suppose that you recently bought a new car, but now you regret the decision and wish you'd purchased a different make and model. Assuming the car is safe and functional, the exact type of car you drive has little bearing on your enduring happiness and satisfaction. In fact, whatever car we own, plain or swanky, we get used to it pretty quickly. So while you might try to find a future-facing lesson from the regret, next time check the consumer guides more carefully before purchasing a vehicle, you should also at least it. Think about how it could have turned out worse. At least I got a good deal. At least I didn't buy that other make and model which had less trunk space. At least it's paid off. At least can turn regret into relief. On their own, they don't change our behavior, but they change how we feel about our behavior, which can be valuable. And because at least spring to mind naturally far less often than if onlys, we must summon them ourselves at the right time. At least work like antibiotics. Sometimes we need to reach into the medicine cabinet and pop a few of them to fortify our psychological immune system and fight off certain harmful emotions. If we use these antibiotics too often, their efficacy will wane. If we use them intelligently, they can aid in healthy functioning. So, with action regrets that are bringing you down, ask yourself, how could the decision I now regret have turned out worse? What is one silver lining in this regret? How would I complete the following sentence? At least? As I was working on this book, Jeff was still working on undoing his regret through through the slow and painful process of tattoo removal. It would require several more sessions and even more money. At least he didn't choose a larger font.
Ao longo da vida, ter dedicado meu tempo aos estudos para a menta, racionais, e ter deixado de lado o conhecimento das emoções e sentimentos.
Throughout my life, I have devoted my time to studying the rational mind and have neglected understanding emotions and feelings. Female, 40, Brazil.
I regret ignoring my inner voice and not heeding its plea to be more adventurous, moving country, changing job when the boss sucks, and for trying to live up to the expectations of society instead of focusing on myself. Female, 47, Singapore.
I regret picking up a pack of Camel cigarettes on the way to a grim business meeting in 1999. To this day, I smoke, sometimes heavily, out of habit more than enjoyment. Male, 44, West Virginia.
13. Disclosure, compassion, and distance. When last we met Cheryl Johnson, she was contending with a connection regret. She'd led a devoted friendship with Jen, college classmate, drift apart over 2 decades, and she missed the closeness and camaraderie they'd once enjoyed. Hers is a regret of inaction, so she can't undo it. It's not possible to reverse a 25-year void. She can't at least it either. Saying, "Our friendship evaporated, but at least we didn't have a huge fight," doesn't offer much solace or meaningfully adjust the present. Cheryl's best response, and the optimal response to most regrets, action and inaction alike, is to use the regret to improve the future. If we look backward with the specific intent of moving forward, we can convert our regrets into fuel for progress. They can propel us towards smarter choices, higher performance, and greater meaning. And science shows us how. Rather than ignoring the negative emotion of regret, or worse, wallowing in it, we can remember that feeling is for thinking and that thinking is for doing. Following a straightforward 3-step process, we can disclose the regret, reframe the way we view it and ourselves, and extract a lesson from the experience to remake our subsequent decisions. Step 1. Self-disclosure. Relive and relieve. Monkeys have constructed incredibly complex societies, but they have yet to establish a central bank that prints money and regulates its supply. Thus, when primatologists try to quantify what monkeys value, they introduce what they call a liquid currency, and what we non-primatologists call juice. By measuring how much fruit juice monkeys demand to behave the way researchers want, and how much they're willing to sacrifice to behave the way monkeys want, scientists can price primate priorities. Robert Diener, Amit Khera, and Michael Platt, previously at Duke University, helped develop the technique, and in 2005, they used it to measure how much a group of male macaques valued signals of status and sex. The experimenters discovered that if they wanted monkeys to look at photos of a low-status macaque, they had to bribe them with lots of juice. But photos of high-status monkeys and of female macaque hindquarters were so enticing that the monkeys were willing to forgo juice just to glimpse them. In other words, the monkeys required liquid payment to view unimportant monkeys, but were willing to pay to look at powerful or attractive monkeys, all of which suggests that these animals place a high value on markers of dominance and sexual fitness. In 2012, the psychologists Diana Tamir, now at Princeton University, and Jason Mitchell of Harvard University, used a modified version of this technique to assess what those macaques' close relatives, human beings, value most. In one study, Tamir and Mitchell presented their participants 3 choices: to reveal their beliefs about themselves, to judge the beliefs of other people, or to answer a trivia question. And they offered to pay varying amounts of money for each activity. Over 195 trials, people's preferences were clear. They loved talking about themselves. So much, in fact, that they were willing to take significantly less money for doing that than for any other behavior. Just as monkeys are willing to forego juice rewards to view dominant groupmates, individuals were willing to forego money to disclose about the self, Tamir and Mitchell wrote. When Tamir and Mitchell then used functional magnetic resonance imaging to watch what was happening in the brains of these people, they saw that those who disclosed information about themselves had greater activation in the brain regions, the nucleus accumbens, and the ventral tegmental area that respond to food, money, and sex. The study, the researchers concluded, provided both behavioral and neural evidence that self-disclosure is intrinsically rewarding. The first step in reckoning with all regrets, whether regrets of action or inaction, is self-disclosure. We're often skittish about revealing to others negative information about ourselves. It feels awkward, even shameful. But an enormous body of literature makes clear that disclosing our thoughts, feelings, and actions, by telling others or simply by writing about them, brings an array of physical, mental, and professional benefits. Such self-revelation is linked to reduced blood pressure, higher grades, better coping skills, and more. Indeed, Tamir and Mitchell maintain that our species may have an intrinsic drive to disclose thoughts to others. Self-disclosure is especially useful with regret. Denying our regret taxes our minds and bodies. Gripping them too tightly can tip us into harmful rumination. The better approach is to relive and relieve. By divulging the regret, we reduce some of its burden, which can clear a path for making sense of it. For example, psychologists like Sonia Lubomirsky of the University of California, Riverside, have conducted studies that suggest people should process negative and positive experiences in different ways. In this research, writing about negative experiences like regret, and even talking into a tape recorder about them for 15 minutes a day, substantially increased people's overall life satisfaction and improved their physical and mental well-being in ways that merely thinking about those experiences did not. Yet the reverse was true for positive experiences. Writing and talking about triumphs and good times drained some of their positivity. The explanation, and the reason self-disclosure is so crucial for handling regret, is that language, whether written or spoken, forces us to organize and integrate our thoughts. It converts blobby mental abstractions into concrete linguistic units. That's a plus for negative emotions. Again, regret can make us better when we use emotions as a signal for our thoughts. When feeling is for thinking, and thinking is for doing, regret can perform its decision-enhancing, performance-boosting, meaning-deepening magic. Writing about a regret or revealing a regret to another person moves the experience from the realm of emotion into the realm of cognition. Instead of those unpleasant feelings fluttering around uncontrollably, language helps us capture them in our net, pin them down, and begin analyzing them. By contrast, the same approach for positive experiences is less effective. For life's happy moments, avoiding analysis and sense-making helps us maintain the wonder and delight of these moments. Dissecting terrific events can diminish their terrificness. One misgiving we have with self-disclosure, particularly if we're revealing our previous failures to be prudent, trustworthy, or courageous, is that others will think poorly of us. But that is much less of a concern than we realize. One can go too far, of course. Oversharing intimate details about yourself can make others uneasy. But the evidence shows that self-disclosure builds affinity much more often than it triggers judgment. One major review of the literature concluded that people who engage in intimate disclosures tend to be liked more than people who disclose at lower levels. Still, if you're squeamish about what others think of you, you needn't disclose your regret to anybody but yourself. The path-breaking work of social psychologist James Pennebaker of the University of Texas, begun in the 1990s and expanded by him and other scholars in the last 30 years, has shown that merely writing about emotional difficulties, even solely for your own consumption, can be powerful. Among the benefits, fewer visits to physicians, long-term improvements in mood, strengthened immune function, better grades for students, finding jobs more quickly for the unemployed, and more. In addition, Pennebaker has determined that these benefits extend widely. The disclosure phenomenon appears to generalize across settings, many individual difference factors, and several Western cultures, and is independent of social feedback. The initial step in dealing with all forms of regret is to disclose the regret. Cheryl Johnson has done that, first by completing the World Regret Survey, and then by talking with me about the strong friendship she failed to maintain. In our conversations, she told me she'd never told anyone the full tale of her experience, and that brought a moment of clarity and a measure of relief. Self-disclosure is intrinsically rewarding and extrinsically valuable. It can lighten our burden, make abstract negative emotions more concrete, and build affiliation. So, to begin to harness your regrets to improve the future, try any of the following. Write about your regret for 15 minutes for 3 consecutive days. Talk about your regret into a voice recorder for 15 minutes for 3 consecutive days.